Scott Janus joins me this week to talk about recent research into dry hopping. This is Beersmith Podcast number 243.
This is the Beersmith Home Brewing Show, where brewing great beer is our passion. If you want to take your brewing to the next level, visit beersmith.com, where you can download a trial version of our Beersmith software, subscribe to the newsletter, and get dozens of free articles on home brewing. And now, your host and the author of Home Brewing with Beersmith, Brad Smith.
This is Beersmith Podcast number 243, and it's early September 2021. Scott Janish joins me this week to talk about recent research into dry hopping. Thank you to this week's sponsors, Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Every issue of Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine is packed with articles for homebrewers and beer lovers. They offer access to videos, brewing courses, exclusive articles, and the amazing Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Go to beerandbrewing.com to get your subscription today. And also the Brew Commander, the new brewhouse controller from Blickman Engineering. It's available in electric and gas propane models. The patent-pending Brew Commander is a high-quality brewhouse controller that offers automated step mashing, boil timers, precision temperature control, and advanced settings. Command your brew day with the new Brew Commander. To order yours today, go to BlickmanEngineering.com. Again, that's BlickmanEngineering.com. And finally, I'm happy to say the new web-based version of Beersmith is available now at BeersmithRecipes.com. Beersmith for the Web lets you build, edit, and brew recipes from any browser, including your desktop, tablet, or mobile device. The new web-based version gives you access to tens of thousands of recipes, online recipe editing, advanced water tools, and much more. You can try Beersmith Web for 30 days by setting up an account at beersmithrecipes.com. If you purchase a Gold, Platinum, or Pro license, you get Beersmith Web and the desktop version for one low price. Check out beersmithrecipes.com now to give Beersmith Web a try. And now let's jump into this week's episode. Today on the show, I welcome Scott Janish. Scott is author of the book, The New IPA, A Scientific Guide to Hop Aroma and Flavor, and also the co-founder of Sapwood Cellars Brewery in Columbia, Maryland. And you're a co-founder with Michael Tonsmeyer, right?
That is right. We teamed up years ago, met through our local DC homebrewers group, and hit it off well. And we're both, you know, big time into beer, big time into brewing. And so that's kind of how we got to talking about doing something as foolish as opening a brewery.
And yeah, Michael's been on the show a number of times talking about Sapwood Cellars. How are things going at Sapwood Cellars right now? I guess you're kind of hopefully enjoying a post-COVID recovery here, or?
Yeah, I think we were, we've definitely been fortunate that, you know, even during the height of COVID, you know, we are still, you know, selling a lot of beer. In fact, we even expanded a little bit to, you know, we weren't really canning hoppy beers before that point. And it turns out when you start putting stuff in cans, the volume of beer that goes out the door starts to increase quite a bit. So we've been, like I said, pretty lucky. And you know, and we actually just this weekend, we're kind of recovering, I guess you could say, from we did a 2-day Oktoberfest event with, you know, bands and the whole nine yards at the farm that takes our grain to feed his cattle. So it was a fun weekend, but definitely a long and tiring one out in the sun.
Did you have the tuba bands and everything?
We got Oompa some bands. No, that would have been too authentic. We just authentic. Got whatever bands would be willing to play in the 90 degree heat. So,
yeah. Well, today you wanted to talk a little bit about post-fermentation hop oils. And I actually just had Stan Hieronymus on, I think it was in the last episode, discussing the Yakima Handbook on Hop Survivability, which you've probably seen. But I understand you're also doing a lot of work in this area. Is that true?
Yeah, it's one of those areas, and I know Stan just wrote a great article on using these oils too. It's just, you know, every time there's a new hop product that comes out, whether it's, you know, a yeast strain that can work with hops, or, you know, a new experimental variety, or in this case, you know, steam distilling hop oils, I always get excited to experiment and play a little bit with them and try to figure out if they're worth using and how to use them. And I guess, you know, most importantly, if they can help improve the beer, because I guess that's always the main goal.
Well, it's kind of an exciting time with hops and IPA, you know, with the IPA explosion. I know it's more than half the craft beer produced in the United States. There's just so much interest now in particularly in aroma oils and whirlpool hopping and dry hopping, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of everyone's trying to, or, you know, a lot of people are trying to just push the envelope a little and you know, just try to pack in as much, you know, hop flavor and aroma into the beers as they can. But I think there's definitely a good balance to be stricken when it comes to, you know, how much to dry hop and maybe how to do it. And then especially when you start thinking about using some of these hop oils, you know, really considering, you know, when to use them in the process and how much to use and what types to use. And so it's, yeah, I think, you know, the IPAs are, you know, everyone, I'm sure would agree they're here to stay. And I think it's exciting that new products keep coming out that can, you know, allow brewers to even further tweak them. You know, really when it comes to hop oils, it's exciting for, you know, I think homebrewers in particular, because you know, as being a home brewer a long time and even being a brewery owner, but we're still on the smaller scale, you know, we're not out there picking our hops. We're not, you know, out in Yakima rubbing, a bunch of different hop varieties and, or different lots of the same variety to pick, you know, our lot for the year. That's, you know, kind of reserved for the breweries that have, a little more buying power. And so if, you know, you kind of get whatever hops you get. And so, you know, if you're at the homebrew store, you know, there's a couple bags of Citra, I mean, that's kind of what you're going to get. And so, you know, sometimes that's they work out great and they smell, you know, excellent out of the bag. And sometimes, you know, they'll be a little lackluster or, you know, just not quite as bright as you were hoping. And that's really where my experimentation with these hop oils, at least the direction I was going with them is, you know, just trying to add a little bit more of that top note to some of these hoppy beers, trying to amplify, you know, what's already there, not to make anything taste, you know, like it doesn't belong or artificial, but, you know, using a hop oil from, you know, if you use a Citra hop oil, it's made from Citra hops and Citra only, figuring out a way to, you know, add that to the beer in a way that adds complexity and brightness and just kind of elevates it.
Yeah, I know what you mean about packages being not so great sometimes. I've gone and I've gone and done big samples sometimes with commercial brewers and you know, like 1 out of 10 or sometimes more are really not that great. So you know, I encourage people before you brew your beer is actually open up a package of hops, make sure it's not one of those stinkers, right?
Yeah, one of those stinkers. Yeah, exactly. And that can be, you know, frustrating. And you know, even at the brewery, I mean, this is, you know, might not be practical for everyone, but we like to have, you know, sometimes if, you know, we're going to brew a beer with Galaxy, for example, we might try to buy some bags from a few different suppliers just to, you know, see which one we open and it smells better, and then we can order more of that same one.
Yeah.
Or as a home brewer, you know, I'd sometimes buy, you know, if I had a batch coming up, I would buy a little more than I needed just to open them. And when it came to dry hopping and using the ones that I thought smelled a little better, and then, you know, sneaking some of those extra ones into, you know, your mash or into the whirlpool, are good places for some of those hops that don't quite fit the bill for dry hopping.
Well, you recently put together an MBAA article called Dry Hop Best Practices. Let's start maybe with an overview of the article, and I think you had a section on what's actually being extracted from the hops.
Yeah, that was a fun one for me to put together as someone who has been a big fan of academic papers like that for a long time and used, I don't know how many hundred citations in the book that I put together. And so it was kind of a thrill when John Palmer reached out and asked if I'd be willing to put together a paper like that. And so I did my best to kind of pull together a lot of the research out there on dry hopping, and, you know, particularly like the ways to improve extraction, what different compounds you're getting, potential problems that might arise, ways to potentially push the flavor a little bit more or control the flavor, depending on different ways to dry hop. And so it was a fun article to put together. And I think you specifically asked, what kind of compounds are actually being extracted when you dry hop. And I think the answer is it kind of depends. So if you're dry hopping, I think during mid fermentation, just that impact of fermentation going on and having yeast in suspension, you're really going to push out and drive out some of those more volatile compounds. I like to think of the hops in having three main classes of different compounds, and mm-hmm. you have your hydrocarbons, which represent the largest percentage of the total oil, followed by the monoterpene alcohols, and that's followed by a real small percentage, which is your sulfur compounds. Mm-hmm. And so the starting back from the beginning, those hydrocarbons are the ones that are the most volatile. So that means they're harder to get into your beer because they don't get into suspension as easily. So if you're dry hopping mid fermentation, you're probably going to lose a lot of those hydrocarbons, which is mainly the myrcene and the other sesquiterpenes that are generally described as being more resinous, woody, spicy, and so those will dry hop. Those will be in your beer at higher amounts if you're doing that post fermentation. The monoterpene alcohols like linalool and geraniol, those are a lot more polar, which means they're easier to get into your beer, and they have a little bit more staying power, especially if you're doing this adding hops in the whirlpool at slightly cooler temperatures. They'll retain themselves a little bit more. And then, of course, the sulfur compounds is mainly what we're talking about there, or focused on is thiols, which I think we'll probably touch on a little bit. So, it really just kind of depends on the hop and what the oil makeup is and when you're using those hops in the process, I think. But generally speaking, it's kind of hard to get these compounds into your beer. Thomas Shellhammer has a great paper that I just referenced in the my latest post on these hop oils, where he tested the hops themselves for just like their oil potential. And then they dry hopped a beer, and then they tested the beer for compounds. And then they again tested the spent hops just to see what remained. And when it came to some of the hydrocarbons like myrcene, it was amazingly, I think it was less than 1% of those, less than 1% of the myrcene was actually still actually extracted into the beer.
Wow.
Which is crazy when you consider that some of these hops are 60-70% myrcene. And when it comes to the monoterpene alcohols, they were much better. Mm-hmm. I think like linalool was around 40%. And it would be interesting to think about ways to potentially use some of those spent hops that clearly still have a lot of potential in them, especially if you look at certain precursors for other compounds. But so dry hopping is a relatively inefficient process, and so that's why it's kind of fun to look at ways to maybe increase that efficiency a little bit, which can come through oils or through other means.
Well, and obviously there are also aromatic compounds, and pretty much by definition, aromatic compounds are aromatic because they don't like to stay in solution, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's true.
Otherwise, you wouldn't smell them. If they like to stay in solution, you never smell them, right?
That's the problem. I think Mike and I, whenever we're, dropping dry hops from our tank, which means, we have a conical fermenter, and we just open it up and let those hops come out after a few days of extraction. And sometimes I get a little nervous if they smell too good, because you're like, no, we wanted that aroma in the beer, so it is tricky to maximize dry hopping. But I think, there's ways. I think, like, for example, using means to agitate your dry hops is a good way to maybe increase that.
Yeah.
Or recirculation. I think for homebrewers, that can be as simple as, you know, when you dry hop, if you're dry hopping in a keg or, you know, something where you can put a little pressure on, I think is even better. Just picking up that keg a little bit and shaking it, just to try to get those hops back in solution where they're going to actually do their extracting.
Well, let's walk through the three groups of compounds you talked about. The first one's hydrocarbons, and I think you mentioned myrcene's probably the most significant. So myrcene, of course, is the largest aroma oil in most of the U.S. hops anyways. What's the impact from the hydrocarbons and kind of flavors you get from it?
I think these are, though, you know, I think in general, I would say, you know, the hydrocarbons and as well as the monoterpene alcohols are kind of more, I consider them more like role players in terms of creating some of the hop flavors and aromas you're after. The hydrocarbons themselves are not really the ones that I think you would want in high amounts when you're talking about, you know, bright tropical citrus forward IPAs, just because these are more that woody, green, resinous, kind of herbal
piney,
I think, compounds. Right? Yeah, and piney. And really just to kind of bring it back towards the hop oils, this is where I have the most concern, not concern, but just my thought process into knowing how these are kind of made and how they're emulsified to get these oils into the solution. So essentially, if you're taking let's use Citra, like a 70% myrcene Citra hop, and you make a oil that is, representing that same sort of hop total oil compound, but it's in a state that's in an oil and it's emulsified and it's likely to get into your beer at much higher rates than a typical dry hopping, as we said, is pretty inefficient. I worry that some of these dry oils could, especially if used in too high amounts, could really give you a green and resinous beer that's, really herbal. And I don't have a good way to explain it other than really extracty. I don't know if you've ever smelled extract, but, and so that's just, I think, an example of you have this oil that represents the hop, but it's in a state that's way easier to get in solution. And so if used too much, some of those hydrocarbons that represent most of it could dominate in a way that I don't think you would see with traditional pellet dry hopping.
So, I mean, we mentioned myrcene. Can you mention a few of the other hydrocarbons?
Yeah, I mean, myrcene is pretty much the dominant one, as we said, is right. Kind of one of the highest ones, and I focus the most on. But, humulene, caryophyllene, thymine, these are the other ones that are looked at in some research. But I think when it comes to dry hopping, this is the class of compounds that I think you are kind of the least important because they're much harder to retain. There is interesting work done by Dr. John Paul May, who works for Hopsteiner. Mm-hmm. Where they tested a bunch of commercial hazy IPAs. And it was interesting that the hazy IPAs actually retain more of these hydrocarbons than, some of like a West Coast IPA. And, there's probably one of the thoughts is it might just be because, hazy IPAs are just so much thicker, more viscous, that they might just be retaining some of those otherwise more volatile compounds. So, that's just kind of an interesting thing when you think about, a class of the hop oils that don't seem to have a huge impact on beers, but, it depends on the style and you might actually get a little bit more of those. And in general, I think a little bit of hydrocarbons, a little bit of that myrcene is great just to give you that like fresh green out of the bag hop smell that's just nice and bright. Mm-hmm. But too much, I think, can have the opposite impact, which can lead to beers that are a little too aggressive and are hiding those fruitier compounds that you might want from hops.
And myrcene's fairly volatile too, isn't it?
Yeah, and so that's why, like, if you use it in the kettle, you pretty much will lose almost all of it.
Yeah.
And like we said, in dry hopping, it was like less than 1% in one of those in Shellhammer's paper and. But like I said, if you're using some oils that completely change that, and that would definitely up that amount, but it would just, you'd have to be careful when you're using an oil like that because it could take it into that level that we, you know, kind of mentioned would be a little, wouldn't taste the greatest, I would think. And I know that from experience. I've been dosing some of these oils that you can get through various suppliers now. And it's fun to use these because you can test them, you know, in a glass post-fermentation. You know, this
you're talking about individual oils, right? And you talk about isolated hop oils because I've also seen the ones where they have the drops that are, you know, one particular brand like Citra or something like that.
Yeah. So individual like hop variety specific oils. So, yeah. You know, Totally Natural Solutions has some, Hop Steiner has some, there's a company, I think it's Glacier Hop Ranch sells some. And so these are, you know, emulsified oils that are ready to put right into your beer. But, you know, you can do this in a glass in just tiny amounts post-fermentation just to see how much you might want to jump into a keg, for example, just to up the flavor a little bit more. And so, you know, through our experiments at the brewery dosing some of these hops, it's interesting that, you know, you can completely transform a beer and sometimes not in a good way by adding these in too high amounts. But in other beers, particularly ones that are already pretty heavily dry hopped, they weave in pretty well and can, you know, add a nice top note and I think improve the beer. But every variety is different. And, you know, that's why it's nice to experiment with these in a glass where you don't have to worry about ruining your entire batch.
Well, the next group you talk about is monoterpene alcohols. And this is one that has, you know, become very popular now, particularly for developing these fruity IPAs, right?
Yeah. And, you know mainly these are, you know, like your linalool and geraniol and, you know, beta citronellol. Again, these are getting into your beer during dry hopping at higher rates, you know, probably closer to 30-40% from some papers. Which is still kind of interesting because that means there's still quite a bit left in the hop when you're done. But these are generally, most of the research has pointed to some of the compounds, especially linalool, as kind of being a marker of, you know, of hoppiness in beers. Mm-hmm. You know, there's so many different compounds, but they, you know, kind of have to select some that they think have an impact, are actually lasting through the process. And so, you know, linalool is, you know, until, you know, thiols have came out, have really been, you know, one of those compounds that, it has looked at to, you know, if you're dry hopping at different temperatures, how much linalool do you get with the same variety? If you're agitating or not, how much linalool? So that's kind of been one of those, that has been a marker of hoppiness. But you know, I think, you know, as I said earlier, I think they're more of a role player. And that's potentially just through their synergistic abilities to work with other compounds, and really it's just their compounds like thiols, I think, that can really really drive up the flavor in beers.
And I know Stan mentioned that you know, like geraniol has been associated with a lot of these active, you know, biotransformations happening during fermentation, where you hop at the end of fermentation or right after high Kroisen. Do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, so like geraniol, one of the few biotransformation processes that can happen that we know is happening in ale strains is taking something like geraniol and it gets transferred into beta citronellol. So it gets, you know, a little bit more citrusy than, you know, rose like. Mm-hmm. And that's so what you'll see is, you know, ale strains, you'll see the geraniol content go down during fermentation and you'll see the beta citronellol concentrations go up. And so that's kind of a great, one of the best ways that typical ale strains can biotransform compounds. Mm-hmm. But generally that's pretty much all that it does. Typical ale strains for the most part. It's really, you need certain enzymes to unlock, you know, bound compounds from hops. So for example, you know, bound monoterpene alcohols, you would need beta glucosidase is the enzyme that will, you know, can actually free and increase the concentration of those hops for potentially extracting into beer. Mm-hmm. But the problem is, most normal ale strains don't create that enzyme typically during fermentation. So right. You can add some of those enzymes in directly. But you know, as I said, I think whatever you can do to kind of push those flavors, I think will help in the long run, even though, you know, it might be, you know, some of these free thiols that really are the compounds that have the biggest impact on flavor, but those are also pretty hard to retain in beer, it turns out.
Interesting. So so you really believe that these are kind of enablers for the thiols? Is that what you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think they're definitely needed just to kind of build in complexity. I think if you had a beer where you just, you know, had a way to pump in thiols on their own, you know, thiols are the third class that, you know, we of hops, oils, and, you know, they're sulfur compounds. They're tiny bit of the hops total oil, but their sensory impact can be big just because, you know, they're so potent. It doesn't take much of a thiol to get in. So, you know, thiols like 3MH is grapefruit leaning, 4MMP, like kind of a black currant thing, which can get into your beer through dry hopping, particularly 4MMP. But I think if you just had a beer and you had a way to just put 4MMP in, I think it would lose. It just wouldn't taste the same. It might, you know, be slightly fruity, but it just wouldn't have that complexity that you would need because you didn't have all those other compounds. You know, hops are just so advanced. There's so many different, you know, 1,000+ compounds in hops. And so, you know, even things like polyphenols and, you know, things that are probably a little aggressive and abrasive and too high of amounts from hops, but, you know, at lower amounts can have a positive impact on things like mouthfeel and, you know, generating just flavor complexity. So
polyphenols even play an important role in head retention, right?
Yeah. And it's interesting. There's almost, you know, so it gets to the point sometimes where you're, the more you learn, the more you kind of scratch your head and you don't know what you're supposed to do. But like when it comes to, you know, polyphenols, I think it's interesting at, you know, too high of amounts. There's been papers that find that makes the beer really astringent, kind of hard to drink. It has that trailing sort of vegetal bite that you can get in heavily, heavily dry hop beers. And so things like dry hopping a little cooler can actually help. Will reduce the amount of polyphenols you get. I think I forget the exact temperatures that I cite in the paper, the MBAA paper, but I think it was like dry hopping at like 66 degrees versus 39 degrees. There's like a twofold increase of polyphenols at the higher dry hop temperature.
Yeah.
And so that kind of goes the same with hydrocarbons too. Myrcene, for example, was retained at higher amounts in the warmer temperature and
that's, too I high mean, that's, that's not really a surprise though, because, you know, the whirlpool, one of the main reasons you do the whirlpool would be to drive more hop oils in, you know, through increased solubility at the higher temperature, right?
Yeah. I mean, so the higher temp being too high, you might lose more than you want, but, you know, I think one paper I love to cite or talk about, and I kind of wish this would be studied again because it's interesting to look at different hop varieties with different whirlpool temperature scenarios. But it was about 180 degrees was kind of where they found in this one test that they retained a good amount of compounds at this temperature, and, you know, they were fruity, you know, fruitiest at around that range. Whereas if they went too low, it got a little more herbal, kind of changed the collection of different classes that we're getting into the beer. So yeah, the temperature is, it's interesting that, you know, I think most homebrewers and, you know, I count myself, I used to just dry hop at the end of fermentation when the temperature was the highest. So, you know, you typically raised your ferment to, you know, above 68, 70, 72, 73 degrees, somewhere in there to help the fermentation finish off and then dry hop. But it turns out that at those higher temperatures, you are, you know, potentially getting some more of the polyphenols that can be astringent, more of the myrcene, which in too high amounts, I think, can add to that astringent kind of green bite. And other problems with warmer dry hopping is, you know, you have a greater chance at having what's called hop creep,
Yeah.
So the enzymes responsible that for breaking down some of the dextrins, which are those unfermentable sugars in your wort, those enzymes might be a little more active at those warmer temperatures. So, you know, it's interesting that, you know, potentially dry hopping cooler and for shorter durations might actually help make a beer a little bit more drinkable in that fruity, bright way that, you know, whereas warm dry hopping might not. But, you know, there's every brewery does things differently, especially when it comes to things like hop creep, where some breweries just dry hop warm for a week, let all that happen in the tank, and then drop the temperature and package, where others, you know, dry hop cool and you know, try to keep the enzymes at bay as best they can. So it's what I love about talking to other commercial brewers and home brewers is, you know, there's so many different ways to do things, and there's not really a right or wrong. It's just, you know, what works for you based off experience. But, you know, I like to use the research, the academic papers as at least a guide to understanding, you know, our process and potentially looking at ways to improve it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I do want to go back and revisit thiols. We're just really starting to understand. It's interesting to me that the wine industry has known about thiols for forever and I've been, you know, working on and, you know, enhancing them forever, but we're just really starting to understand how important thiols are, particularly for these IPAs. And I believe, you know, most of the higher level thiols are primarily in the US, New Zealand and Australia hops, right?
Yeah, that's true. And that's especially true with, as it relates to the wine world. Yeah. The wine industry has looked at thiols for a long time, and they're the same ones for the most part. The ones that they're after are the same ones that are in hops. So again, that's like the 3MH, 3MHA, which is kind of a passion fruit one that can be bioconverted from 3MH, and again, 4MMP. So the wine world has looked at ways to use different enzymes and yeast strains to amplify those thiols even more, because again, just a little bit more of those that are released into your beer might get you above that sensory threshold, which means that you would have a, you know, an impact. You could smell and taste the thiol, but they're also very difficult to, unfortunately, get into beer. There was a paper, I believe it was last year, that, you know, tested commercial hazy IPAs again, but this time looking at thiol concentrations. And despite being, you know, pretty heavily dry hop beers, and as much as we talk about thiols really potentially driving flavor and aroma, it was really only 4MMP, which is in hops in a more of a free state, which means they don't need enzymes. Yeah, exactly. It was only 4MMP that was in amounts that were, you know, reached that sensory threshold, and I don't believe any of the beers reached it for 3MH, which just kind of shows, you know, how difficult it can be. And of course, there are ways to potentially improve that even more. And I think, you know, I for a long time was trying to ferment, doing test patches with, you know, wine strains that were particularly good at releasing some of these compounds, and, you know, maybe I was getting some of that biotransformation happening, you know, by having the enzyme that you need for releasing thiols is beta lyase, and mm-hmm. so, you know, again, you know, our typical ale strains aren't creating that during fermentation, and so I was using wine strains that would. But the problem is, you know, the wine strains also brought other phenols and
other off flavors,
esters,
right?
Yeah, that just clashed, and you know, maybe they were biotransforming and I was getting more thiols, but you know, it was just being masked by some of these other fermentation characteristics yeast strain has.
So. Aren't some of the yeast providers starting to experiment with you know, yeast that might enhance these things too?
Yeah, that's genetically engineered strains is kind of the new area that I was particularly excited about, just because it's something I've been chasing for so long. Is, you know, you see all this potential in hops. So, you know, for example, 3MH is in hops in a bound state at much, much higher rates than free. Mm-hmm. And so you really, unless you can tap in and kind of access that, you know, you almost need the key to unlock those flavors. And what they found is in these genetically engineered strains, so this is Omega has one called Cosmic Punch. And Berkeley yeast has one called Tropics. And what they did is they figured out which gene is responsible for creating the beta lyase enzyme during fermentation. And then they would, you know, take that gene, insert it into a strain like a London Ale 3, and turn it up. So they're taking the gene that can bioconvert, putting it in. So they're taking it from one strain to another, putting it in there, cranking it up so it's even more amplified to create that enzyme to free up compounds. And they found, and even I found in some test batches, it really does work and does get you above that those sensory thresholds where you can taste and
freeze up that 3MH. Huh? Yeah.
Yep. Exactly. I mean,
wow.
The 3MH, they were getting higher levels of 3MH tested in beers that weren't even dry hopped than in some of the beers that weren't hopped at all. So they were getting above sensory threshold just from grain, surprisingly, has precursors for the 3MH style.
Interesting.
And the genetically engineered strain was capable of unlocking those thials, precursors, to get you above a sensory threshold, which is pretty fascinating. And it really kind of changes how you use a lot of hops. So, you know, not every hop has the same amount of bound potential. So,
right.
Saws, for example, or Southern Cross are extremely high in bound 3MH. So they found even using these in high levels in the mash, where there's other enzyme activity happening, and then fermenting with one of these genetically engineered strains could really get you some fun fruity results. So it's kind of fascinating. It's also, you know, probably a little bit hard to understand, and I know it's definitely hard for me to talk about it in an easy to understand way, but it's exciting to see more potential in some of these hops that, you know, might otherwise be, you know, cheaper hops that you might not use very often in some of these beers. It kind of, you know, brings a whole new focus to, you know, when to use certain hops, and gives you a lot more intentionality of, you know, when you're using what variety at what point in the process.
So, yeah,
it's fun to experiment with.
And you also talked in your paper about esters from the hops, and I don't usually associate esters with hops, but can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I think so. Here, I'm still not totally sure, you know, what level of impact some of these esters from hops have. The main ester that's looked at is it's called 2-MIB, and so this is like a real apricot type of flavor that, you know, is in different levels with different hops. And it's interesting that, you know, there's been some papers, or one paper that looked at just, you know, using the same hop variety but fermenting with different yeast strains would give you different amounts of that ester in the final beer. So just to throw in another a variable, which it seems like there's too many, but so it looks like, you know, yeast strain that, you know, having certain compounds, in this case esters, interacting with certain types of yeast will result in different amounts. So the process is important, but sometimes, you know, the yeast strain can have just as much of an impact. But in terms of like hops that have have high 2-MIB, which again is that apricot ester, is, you know, Idaho 7 is one that's really high in 2-MIB, and Equinod and Southern Cross, mm-hmm. Pacific Jade. These are, you
some
know,
those are some of the most popular hops, obviously.
Yeah, and those are great ones that we found in our experience to use in the whirlpool. So, you know, potentially, you know, hop esters are something that might retain through you know, the brewing process, you know, the heat and fermentation, and, you know, and be a positive, you know, role player for you know, overall hop flavor. So, you know, in particular, Idaho 7 has been a hop that we found is just really great in the whirlpool. It just has one of those compound or class of compounds that, you know, in fact, Yakima Chief did some research into survivables, which I think you've talked about before on here. And 2-MIB, I think, is one of those compounds they look at. It's like almost working backwards in beer. You know, what's in the final beer? What's in the glass? What compounds are those? And then which hops have the highest amount of those compounds that survive the process, and Idaho 7 happened to be pretty high on that list.
You mentioned there's some interesting things you can do in the process as well. So, I mean, aside from picking the right hops and you know, picking the right time to add the hops, there's process things you can do as well to try and enhance the extraction, right?
Yeah, I mean, like I briefly mentioned rousing hops. So, you know, after you dry hop, particularly in, I think, in smaller containers, homebrew containers, fermenters, the hops drop to the bottom pretty quick. I think, you know, in a giant like 100 barrel tank, I think it just takes longer for those hops to, you know, percolate down to the bottom. But once they're at the bottom, I don't, you know, the hops might be extracting a little, but not as well as if they're kind of floating around in the beer in suspension. So anyway, you can, you know, agitate those hops, I think, to get them back in the beer to extract is a good way to increase your flavor and aroma. And so, like I said, dry homebrewers can simply shake a keg a little bit. You can shoot, like, what we do is we shoot CO2 through the bottom of the cone for about 30, 40 seconds at, like, you know, high PSI, 30, 40 PSI. And you can really just hear the tank bubbling and gurgling away. But it's just, you know, hopefully pushing those hops from the bottom of the cone back up in the beer to extract. So, you know, there's a little bit of ways like that you can try to potentially improve your extraction efficiency.
Is this something you do once, or you do it a couple times a day, or what?
Yeah, we do it once a day at the brewery for most of our hops, and we do a pretty short duration. So we're, you know, two, three days tops, and then we try to get those hops off the beer, whether it's dropping the cone, and then maybe we might do another charge of hops for two or three days, but we're rousing those hops once a day just to try to get them, you know, back into a solution. Potentially, you know, certain hops might benefit from being agitated a little more often. There's a recent paper that looked at, you know, the higher the alpha acid content in hops, the harder it was to get those compounds to extract, almost like the alpha acids are creating some sort of barrier is kind of a way to think about it. So maybe getting those into solution a little more will extract a little better. And, you know, we found hop products like Cryo, which have a lot of that vegetal material removed, seem to want to stay in solution a little better. Perhaps it's just almost, you know, lighter in nature. It's just easier to keep in the beer. So, you know, it's really, I think, the easiest way to think about it is if your hops are sitting in the bottom of your bucket or your carboy, they're probably not doing much. So, you know, agitating them is a good way to pick up a little more flavor.
And you touched on this earlier, but you've got some interesting findings on dry hop time and dry hop temperature as well, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's pretty surprising that a lot of the research papers out there have looked at, you know, dry hopping at cooler temperatures. And for the most part, you're even at cooler temperatures, you know, even, you know, sub 50% or 50 degrees, you're still getting really good extraction. But because of those smaller or those, you know, the result of dry hopping at some of those cooler temperatures, they found there's, you know, some benefits to that, like we were talking earlier about, you know, less of those hydrocarbons that could potentially, and polyphenols, what could make a beer a little greener and more astringent. There was better head retention at some of these cooler temperature ferments. You know, it's, you know, the hop creep issue is potentially improved. The chances of having hop creep might be a little less. And even like duration, so, you know, 2 days, you know, the longer beer sat on hops, the more polyphenols were extracted, for example. So, you know, hotter temperatures and long durations might give you more of a more stringent kind of character from your hops. Reduce your head retention. That was, the longer it was in, dry hops were in contact with beer, the worse of an impact it had on head retention.
And we don't generally leave dry hops in very long now, right?
I mean, yeah, I think when I first was home brewing, it was, you know, a week, 2 weeks. I remember I did one Saison, where it was like a mixed ferment Saison where I dry hopped for, like, I don't know, 3 months or something crazy. Well,
or the extreme would be keg hopping, where you just drop them in the keg and leave them there, right?
Yep. And I've definitely done my share of that too. used to, I don't know if it's my, you know, maybe our palates sort of change as people try different things. I used to do that as a home brewer all the time. I would just leave them in the keg while I was drinking it. But I've since moved to, you know, after I'm dry hop in a keg, I'll dry jump into like a serving keg, just making sure everything's, you know, purged well beforehand, just to hopefully just clean up that taste a little bit, getting a little bit, you know, getting the beer off that vegetal material, I think makes a lot of sense to me.
And what are the things that can go wrong with dry hopping? What are some of the things that might go bad?
Yeah, I think, you know, the hop creep issue we kind of talked about, but that's definitely a potential bad.
Yeah, hop creep, of course, is where the fermentation restarts after you've packaged it, right?
Right, which is very scary if you're, you know, bottles potentially exploding. I know that that's a, you know, it's scary for a home brewer. I've had my share of bottles as a home brewer that, you know, I was afraid to even take out of the box. They're like bottle bombs, you know, grenades. And that can happen from hop creep. So that's an issue.
I've had a few go off too, yeah.
Yeah, and then it's no fun cleaning your ceiling, right?
Yeah, I had a stout go off in the kitchen one time. It was a disaster.
Those stouts are always the worst to clean up.
But
I think, well, other things that could go wrong, you know, oxygen, I think is really the main thing. Every time if you're dry hopping, particularly post fermentation, and you open up your bucket or your fermenter and you're just plopping in hops, you're introducing a lot of oxygen. And it's especially true with hazy IPAs, which just tend to be more sensitive to oxygen. They can, you know, go downhill pretty quick. You'll even see a color change in some of these beers if too much oxygen gets in. So at the brewery, we use like a hop doser where we can actually add, we have like a separate little tank that sits on the top of our big fermenter where we can essentially add all of our hops in a closed manner, shut it, and then purge that container, and then open a valve after it's purged to drop those hops in under pressure, so nothing's actually being exposed. And, you know, I think for home brewing, that's particularly a problem, just because I like to think about it like, if we open up our 4-inch hop port on the top of our tank that's, you know, 600 plus gallons of beer, you know, if you compare that to opening your bucket that's only 5 gallons of beer, it's just so much more oxygen that's getting in or in contact with a smaller amount of beer. So I'm a big proponent of home brewers trying to keep out oxygen as much as possible through, you know, closed transfers or dry hopping in separate vessels that are purged with the hops in before purging, or you know, anything you can really do to try to keep out oxygen.
Well, Scott, we're coming up near the end here, but I wanted to give you a minute to talk about your new book.
Yeah, so the new IPA, it's, you know, been out for a little while now, but it was, you know, something that I just did on the side for, you know, about 2 years, where it was really just printing off hundreds of different academic papers and sitting around with a highlighter trying to see what I could learn and piece together. Mostly just, you know, I just was amazed by how much information was out in the world about, you know, brewing beer and hoppy beer in particular, and how much that I don't, you know, went unnoticed. Not a lot of people were looking at a lot of these papers because they can be a little challenging to read and understand. But, you know, I did my best to try to piece it together in a way that would, you know, whether it's interviewing some of the other breweries or interviewing some of the authors of these papers, and, you know, just trying to see what I could learn and how it might be able to be applied to understanding hoppy beer, particularly hazy hoppy beer, and hopefully inspire use from the science brewers to try new things, try new ingredients, try ingredients at different times in the process, just to get hopefully the end goal is to make better beer. So it's a very scientific read. It's not one that you probably read start to finish, but it's more of a, if you're interested in a particular thing, you can kind of delve into it that way. But I'm glad it's out there, and hopefully people enjoy it.
And again, that's the book is called The New IPA, and I'll include it in the show notes. And of course, you're from Sapwood Cellars, which I'll also mention is Columbia, Maryland. But Scott, I wanted to ask you, could you give us your closing tips for homebrewers before we end here?
Yeah, sure. You know, closing tips, you know, I think I kind of was talking about it earlier. I think when it comes to brewing hoppy beer, I think if as a homebrewer, I was more concerned if I was going to spend money on homebrew gear, my rules were kind of, I wanted to, is it going to save me time? Is it going to help, you know, shave some time off my brew day? And the other, is it going to make my beer better? And I think if you're investing money into the cold side of brewing, I think that's probably where I would focus my finances, just to keep oxygen out. So, you know, buying fermenters that allow you to put pressure on them so you can transfer out with CO2 on the head pressure, going into a keg that's already purged of oxygen, allowing you to, you know, potentially even purge some of your lines before beer hits them, you know, little things like that. I think oxygen is unfortunately one of those things that can really impact hoppy beer on the homebrew level. And so that's, if I had one tip, it would be to kind of invest in that cold side.
Well, Scott, really appreciate you coming on the show today. Thank you so much for being here and talking about dry hops.
Absolutely. And thank you very much for having me. It was fun.
And today my guest is Scott Janisch. Scott is the author of the book, The New IPA. He's also co-founder at the Maryland brewery, Sapwood Cellars, which is located in Columbia, Maryland. Thanks again, Scott.
Yep, thank you.
A big thank you to Scott Janisch for joining me this week. Thanks also to Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. They offer access to videos, brewing courses, exclusive articles, and the amazing Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Go to beerandbrewing.com to get your subscription today. And also the Brew Commander, the new brewhouse controller from Blickman Engineering. It's available in electric, gas, propane models. The patent-pending Brew Commander is a high-quality brewhouse controller that offers automated step mashing, boil timers, precision temper control, and advanced settings. Command your brew day with the new Brew Commander. To order yours today, visit blickmanengineering.com. Again, that's blickmanengineering.com. Finally, I'm happy to say the new web-based version of Beersmith is available now at beersmithrecipes.com. Beersmith through web lets you build, edit, and brew recipes from any browser, including your desktop, tablet, or mobile device. You can try Beersmith web for free for 30 days by setting up an account at beersmithrecipes.com. If you purchase a gold, platinum, or pro license, you get both Beersmith web and the desktop version for one low price. Go to beersmithrecipes.com today to give it all a try. I'd like to thank you for listening, and I hope you have a great brewing week.